The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you had a fascinating discussion with actually the architect of the European Central Bank, or one of the main architects. You know, I think of Europe for the last several thousand years being so war-torn and worn down with disagreements, not only financially or economically, but of course militarily, politically and strategically. And he seemed to be very, very motivated by the background that created that kind of tension.
Yeah. At the end of The Birth of the Euro, which is the book that Mr. Issing wrote in 2008, he reflects on that first year experience at the European Central Bank, sitting at lunch with the vice president of the ECB, Christian Neuer, and discovering that Christian Neuer's father was a French soldier who was interned in the German prisoner of war camps at the same time his own father was part of the German occupying force in France. Mm. And the irony that 50 years later, these two sons of former combatants were working together to develop the European Central Bank and to make the euro a common currency, to make it a success, not only for France and Germany, but the rest of Europe. And it is with an underlying passion, an underlying sense of history that the ECB was put into place. It's interesting, Kevin, to look at what was, you know, prior to the euro existing, the US dollar was a given as the world's reserve currency. Sure. And it didn't matter if you liked or didn't like it. It was the status quo and was going to remain the status quo. What is now an environment where the dollar is still important, but the euro is quickly becoming more and more and more important. Now, we have experienced a number of speed bumps as the fiscal irresponsibility of some of the southern states within Europe are compromising some of the integrity of the EMU. But from a monetary standpoint, from a monetary management standpoint, the ECB was set up with a tremendous amount of integrity in terms of its structure. And Otmar is responsible in large part for that. And we will see what will be over the next few years. Will the euro continue to gain preeminence on the world scene? Will it at some point eclipse the significance of the US dollar? And we certainly see central banks around the world in recent years making a shift out of dollars and into euros. Does that continue? Does the strength of the euro continue? Does the appeal continue? Or are the issues today of a terminal nature for this currency experiment?
Well, and I think, Dave, calling it an experiment is accurate. This is a grand experiment that has never, ever been tried before, where you are trying to take very politically different countries and merge them, at least in a financial way. Now, I know that that's being challenged right to its very edge right now with Greece and Spain, Italy, Portugal. You named them earlier. It's an experiment that I know many of the people in Europe would like to see work. And this is why we wanted to get inside the head of the actual architect of this structure.
It's been enormously successful. If you think about how quickly, in just a short 10 to 12 year period of time, a currency which did not even exist is now the second most important currency in the world, and actually bond issuance being in total amongst all the countries of the EU greater than U.S. bond issuance. So in the world of bonds as well as in the world of currency trading is immensely important.
Well, why don't we go to that discussion with Otmar Issing that you had just about an hour ago?
Over the last several years, we've had the opportunity to talk to critics of the euro. Today we get to talk to an architect of the euro. Otmar Issing wrote The Birth of the Euro in 2008, a book published by Cambridge University Press, and explores what it looked like in memoir to be a part of the creation of the euro. He began his tenure with the European Central Bank in 1998 and was with them until 2006. Otmar, what would you say is the present challenge that the European Central Bank faces in the current economic crisis?
I think the challenge for the European Central Bank is not so much different from the challenges to other central banks in the world, like the Fed or Bank of England, the central banks had to deal with a financial crisis of a dimension we hadn't seen since 1929 and the following years. And I think the fact that the world has not fallen in a depression is due to the strong intervention of central banks in the world. Also, of course, to fiscal policies. But now the question is how to exit from this policy, which is a very difficult task. Exit should not happen too early, undermining the recovery, and not too late, risking that inflation would be a consequence of this expansionary monetary policy.
The European Central Bank has decided to keep rates at 1%, where they've been since May of 2009. The UK, likewise, at a low rate of about 0.5%, and the US, similarly, at historically low rates. Is there, in your judgment, this challenge of coming out of a low-rate environment, is there any risk at this point of inflation, and would you expect to see rates rising in 2010? Or is this something that requires a greater degree of confidence in terms of economic stabilization, both in those particular countries and globally?
First, I beg your understanding that I've sworn I will never comment on monetary policy of my former central bank. There's nothing worse than the old guys commenting on what the actual incumbent, so to say, should do. But I'm absolutely convinced that the ECB will stick to its mandate, which is to maintain price stability. And if you look into the introductory statements by the president, if you look into the monthly bulletin, etc., you see a clear orientation that ECB will not lose sight of its mandate.
How different is the mandate of the ECB focusing on price stability versus perhaps that of the Fed, looking for stability of prices, specifically asset prices?
I think the Fed's mandate and that of the ECB is in so far different as we have a dual mandate for the Fed, being responsible for price stability, but at the same time for employment. In the case of the ECB, the priority is very clear, maintaining price stability. On asset prices, I think this is one of the most important challenges for central banks in the world, how to deal with asset price developments. The ECB, with its two-pillar strategy, for which I might claim authorship, I think is much better suited to deal with, because as many studies by the BIS and other institutions, ECB included, have shown, there is hardly any asset price bubble in the world in the past which was not accompanied, if not preceded, by strong increases in money and or credit. So looking into the development of money and credit and making it part of the decision on monetary policy implicitly urges the central bank to take also care about asset price developments. I have always disagreed with the notion that central banks should follow what I call an asymmetric approach, not caring when asset prices go up, but do everything when asset prices collapse. Of course, as we have seen in the last crisis, once a bubble bursts, central banks have to provide any liquidity which is needed. The question is, what should they do when asset prices are going upwards? Of course, it's difficult to identify imbalances, to identify a bubble in time. But looking into the development of money and credit, I think, gives you an anchor for your monetary policy decisions.
Well, I remember reading, perhaps a year ago, some comments, maybe longer, some comments in the Financial Times by yourself on the value of M3. As when you're looking at money and credit and determining monetary policy, keeping both an awareness of that, but doing long-range planning, that number is relevant. Is there any reason why other central banks, particularly in the U.S., would have sort of relegated that to the dustbins of history?
Yeah, several comments. First, There were headlines once when the Fed gave up even collecting data on M3, and this was seen as a contradiction to the ECB's monetary analysis, which is in so far nonsense, as the relevant monetary aggregate in the US compared with M3 in Europe is M2, which is still existent. Second point, the monetary analysis and monetary pillar of the ECB strategy doesn't just boil down to monitoring M3 and comparing it with the reference value. The approach is much broader. It was broader from the beginning. It has been further extended. There's a lot of continuing research. The ECB also, at my time and now later, in a number of articles, for example, in the monthly bulletin and quite a number of research papers, has made clear what monetary analysis means. It's a much broader concept. It includes several monetary aggregates. It includes credit, the counterpart, so to say, of monetary developments. And on the basis of that, the monetary analysis is not just reduced to looking into M3. And we see it especially in a time as we are in the present crisis, when the multiplier, so to say, collapses, base money is increasing and M3 is stagnating. Looking just into M3 would give, in M3 alone, would give you a wrong view, a very limited view on the monetary sector.
It's in Chapter 3 of your book, The Birth of the Euro, that you describe the creation process and the things that you wanted to prioritize, looking at each of the monetary policy options and choosing, as you did, the course for the euro. It seems that there has been a greater sensitivity within Europe, perhaps with the European Central Bank, to inflation. Is that from the visceral experiences of the German hyperinflation, both instances in the last century, or perhaps you'd like to comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's certainly true that the fact that in Germany money was totally destroyed, the currency twice in one generation, has left deep imprint in the mind of people in Germany. Now this generation has more or less passed away, but nevertheless, memories of hyperinflation in Germany, even in October 1923, for example, we had monthly inflation rate of 10,000% and more. This is something which people don't forget. But it would be too simple to reduce the inflation or anti-inflation bias of Europeans to the German experience. Also, in times of more moderate inflation rates, still double-digit in some countries, central banks in Europe, before entry into monetary union, have learned and have reached a consensus that even moderate inflation of, let's say, 5 or 6, 7% is too high, is not helping for any problems. It's not the solution, but it's a problem. So the consensus, which was also marked by the definition of price stability by an inflation rate of below 2% annual inflation rate, to be maintained over the medium term, reflects this common conviction, which is, I would claim, now a European conviction and not just one based on German historical experience.
You ask the question in your book, does one size fit all? What began as a project with 11 countries has now expanded to well over 25, and there's still a list of new potential entrants into the EU and the EMU, the monetary unit. Do you feel that there is the possibility of a shift towards a unified political system? Is that necessary for the success of the euro, or is it adequate to have the monetary union, as we've already seen, significant benefits since 1999 and its inception?
This is a big story. I try to make a few remarks on that. First, it was clear from the beginning, and I wrote extensively on that in my book, that the 11 countries forming monetary union at the start in 1999 were anything but representing an optimal currency area. So the introduction of the euro and having a single monetary policy for all, one size has to fit all, would create different developments in some countries. For countries like Spain, for example, the strong decline in the real interest rate would necessarily trigger a boom in housing. This was clear from the beginning. So monetary policy could not do anything about that. There's only one interest rate set by the European Central Bank, which now applies for, in the meantime, 16 countries, which are member of Monetary Union. So if there are divergent developments in some countries, let's say an overheating in the construction sector, it is the duty of the national authorities to implement national measures. And just take the example of Spain. I could refer also to other countries. We in the ECB have warned the Spanish government time and again that this boom would finally lead to a collapse. And the Banco de España, the Spanish National Central Bank, was on our side. Almost there was a monthly warning. So this is explaining what monetary union is and what it is not. It's not a political union. The decision on taxation in the housing sector, etc., is a national decision. But the rules for national policies have changed with entry into monetary union. And this was forgotten. So the present crisis in which we are in, and the case of Greece is just the strongest example for that, is a development which started right from the beginning. One should have avoided that by implementing national measures. Now it's not too late, but the consequences are huge.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
In a period of financial and economic turmoil, is there a way to avoid there being political conflict or even geopolitical crisis as people blame someone else for their own problems, at least at the level of rhetoric? We've seen Greece want to say, focus on your own business and quit fixating on ours. You know, this goes back to World War II and biases. It seems that they've wanted to draw in the past, and perhaps that is only rhetoric, and perhaps that is something that's quite easy to dismiss. But is there the potential for what began as a financial crisis and has morphed into an economic crisis to become a political or geopolitical crisis? Do we have a political crisis in the euro?
You are right. There is also a geopolitical dimension. Consider the tensions between the U.S. and the Chinese authorities on the exchange rate of renminbi. It's difficult to disentangle political and economic issues. But concentrating on Europe, European Union, even on monetary union, I think what we see now has had to be expected. Once countries like Greece get advice from Europe, from Brussels, it's easy to blame European authorities or national governments for their prescriptions, which people, of course, don't like. They have to suffer from those measures, but they are needed. And the rhetoric you mentioned is a very unfortunate accompanying aspect of the present crisis. And I think responsible politicians should not endanger what is the biggest achievement of post-war Europe, that not only war has disappeared as a threat in Europe, but also political tensions of this kind, which are now here and there emerging. I would not take it too serious, but one should warn on the first sides of these things emerging.
Has the team at the European Central Bank faced particular challenges incorporating command economies and integrating them into more of a free market framework?
It's not so much, if at all, a challenge for the European Central Bank. The European Central Bank has a clear and limited and important but limited mandate, conducting a monetary policy for the single currency, the euro, to maintain price stability. And this, of course, is enshrined in a treaty. The ECB is made independent to be able to take the appropriate measures. And now countries which have joined the euro have to live with this regime, which they wanted to have. But the consequences are far-reaching. I think one of the big problems of monetary union is that politicians, not only politicians, but politicians signing the Maastricht Treaty and joining Monte Union just thought that transferring the competence of conducting monetary policy from the National Central Bank to the European Central Bank is enough. That's it. Of course, this is the major element, but the consequences are far-reaching. Wage policy, for example, is different from the past. The tool of devaluating one's own currency has disappeared, so which means that there is not one single sentence in the treaty how to conduct wage policy in the monetary union. But the economic consequences are such that you have to consider maintaining your competitiveness within monetary union, living in a regime without having the exit of devaluating one's own currency, etc. So I think this learning process, what participation in monetary union means now in the crisis, is obvious. And not all countries have already taken the lessons.
It seems there's a number of features which would make the euro that much more attractive to the currency markets. The long term, there may be short term disruptions because you cannot devalue your currency as the British have done this last year by close to 30%. But long term, it seems that that adds stability to the currency. That adds to the success story that you've put in motion back in 1998. And it seems also that having a gold component as a part of the reserves to the euro is an important component. Is that particularly relevant, having gold as a part of the currency that was always one of the attractive subnotes or footnotes to the Swiss franc during a period of economic crisis and inflation during the 70s and early 80s? Are those elements still relevant in the currency markets today?
I'm not a supporter of the importance of gold in our times. Of course, we have seen that once it comes to a crisis, gold as a natural asset, as a rare physical asset, its own value. But I think what is really relevant for the euro is the independence of the central bank and the mandate of maintaining price stability. These are the fundamentals on which the euro is based. If the currency reserves have a gold part on or not in this context is, for me, irrelevant.
Are those assets perhaps better used, as the German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble has suggested, as a part of an emergency economic fund?
I'm not sure if he suggested that. It was said he had suggested. I have not seen any comment by him supporting that view. But I think this is out of the question. The Bundesbank would never agree to such a transfer. So this is an idea which doesn't fly.
You have such vast experience both academically. Up to 1990, you were a professor, a university professor, and then also very practical experience with the Bundesbank and then as a member of the executive board of the European Central Bank. What are your reflections based on your experience of where we're at today and where we're going? Perhaps more philosophical reflections.
This is something which thinking on that increases by age, so to say. Indeed, this is a long story, and perhaps one, in case I would write another book, let's say 10 years' time, if this would be my main interest. But to cut it short, for the time being, I think we are at a turning point. Remember when the 90s of the last century started, there was a lot of talk about the Great Moderation, a situation in which a kind of Goldilocks economy, high growth, low inflation, and many were already celebrating this as a new era. I think what is now at stake is, if it turns out that it was just an episode in the long waves of inflation in the past, changing with short episodes of price stability, or if we can really preserve this great achievement. I think this is what is at stake now. And in fighting still against the consequences of the crisis, one must not lose sight of this long-term goal of maintaining low inflation. Because in the end, societies and especially the poorest people suffer most from a surge in inflation. This is so to say, the mantra for me. And of course, it's not easy for central banks to keep this course when they are attacked, politicians, unions, etc. But this is their task. They have to deliver in the interest of their people.
I want to thank you for joining us. The book that you wrote in 2008, The Birth of the Euro, I would encourage any of our listeners to look at for a historical background, to look at the foundations of the ECB and the considerations that went into the monetary union that impacts our world so greatly today. For a first-hand account, you cannot get a better look into the inner workings of the EMU. So I thank you very much for joining us, and I very much look forward to that next book. I hope we don't have to wait 10 years. Perhaps we can have a discussion then about what your reflections are in total.
Thank you. You're welcome.
David, there were a number of points that you guys covered that I think would be worth looking a little further into. But one of the questions that I have, and I would imagine that some of the listeners had when he was talking about the difference between the mandate for the European Central Bank, which is what he calls price stability, versus, say, the Federal Reserve, which not only looks at price stability, but asset price stability. Could you differentiate the difference in the mind of a central banker as to what he's talking about?
Price stability is definitely more of a focus on inflation, and seeing that there is not more than a modest degree of inflation over a long period of time.
Isn't it 2% that they look for at the European Central Bank?
Yeah, and they have a formula for figuring out what is acceptable in a given year, but roughly 2% is acceptable or below that. What we have in the U.S. is slightly different, with a focus on price stability as well as employment. And what you find is a bit of a shift from independence, which the ECB has stood pretty firm on, its independence from the polities that make up its membership. With the Fed, you have a bit of a shift, and you know what he described as an asymmetric central banking model where you don't care about asset price inflation.
So the bubbles that we saw back in the 1990s and in real estate in the early 2000s.
Exactly. But you are willing to deal with the downside, and that's what the markets here in the U.S. have termed the Greenspan put,
yeah.
At least under the Greenspan
it's
era.
Sort of hypocritical to let the bubbles blow up. And
we've got you covered on the downside, and the upside is wide open, so full throttle ahead. Just know that we've covered the risks for you. That is unacceptable.
I mean, that's what we've termed moral hazard. You just can take any risk you want because you know somebody's there to bail you out.
It is, but that's the tricky side of central banking, is figuring out how to keep a governor on growth when growth is, from a political perspective, something that you're concerned constituents certainly enjoy. So again, the importance of independence from the political arena, and you can see that in The Birth of the Euro, where he makes very clear throughout the book just how important it was to establish that independence in the early years and to establish that sort of integrity, if you will, and maintain it through time.
I thought he was very insightful in talking about what he called the Goldilocks economy, which is high growth, low inflation. You know, a lot of people bought into that being the model now for the rest of time, and he was more circumspect in saying, you know, that probably won't be the model. Let's just see if we can make this work.
Yeah, Francis Fukuyama's book titled The End of History was sort of an illusion back in 1999 and 2000 that we had entered this new golden era and we would only see greater productivity and greater wealth creation, greater peace, prosperity, and democracy spreading across the globe from this point forward. Gone were the days of war, gone were the days of a business cycle downturn, gone were anything that you would consider bad news, and it's not a realistic view of the world. Robert Kagan has subsequently responded with a book, The Beginning of History and the End of Dreams, in a very terse 120-page response.
Sort of countering.
Absolutely. Saying anything but peace and prosperity ad infinitum.
You know, you were talking about the golden era that Fukuyama was talking about, and, you know, again, high growth, low inflation, and I know that that would be the goal of a central bank if they could pull it off, and a central bank really needs to have full monetary control. I thought it was an interesting insight, David, when you brought gold into the conversation. The European Central Bank is a paper monetary entity, just like the Federal Reserve is a paper monetary entity. But it still represents countries where there's politics and geopolitics. You know, gold, he was talking about Deutsche Bank, but Deutsche Bank holds how much gold?
About 3,400 tons, quite a bit of gold.
Yeah, so there still is a backup plan in case this grand experiment doesn't really work. It's interesting, each of these countries still maintains a gold reserve of their own that seems to be outside of this monetary union.
That is fascinating, Kevin. What we continue to look at is the progression from what started as a financial crisis on the balance sheets of a few individual institutions, banking entities particularly, has spread globally into the economy. And you were beginning to see more of a response at a localized or national level in terms of the response to economic pain, constituency-driven, and what is being asked for as a cessation of pain. To a large degree, we've held the system together through a massive increase in liquidity. And as our guest today has pointed out, the risks that exist in the exit strategy from this massive liquidity boost is, if we leave too early, we risk relapse.
Mm-hmm.
And if we leave too late,
inflation.
We risk inflation.
Yeah.
So the exit strategy is just as important as the entry strategy. And if it's not done right, that's where we think things could get particularly complicated, both at the political and the geopolitical level.
Well, we'll have to watch how this plays out. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. You can find us there or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.